Okay, now we can start.
Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA.
If you build it, they will come. Joel, you seen that movie? He's in the movie, Joe.
Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA.
In our 670 The Score studios, Jordan Malley.
Shout out to Jordan Malley.
Did Matt Peck get a signed copy of that book?
No, Matt Peck, he didn't. No.
No.
I'll talk to D. Rose.
Yeah, you're going to make it happen.
And Matt, you will be getting your book soon.
Kick back and get ready for the best hour of your day.
Are players buying in, Jim?
Yes.
Fair enough.
And so all I was saying on this podcast, the Locked On Bulls podcast.
Locked On Bulls, 5 days a week.
Locked On Bulls starts now.
You can just see the vibe.
Here are your hosts, Jordan Malley and Matt Peck.
What's up and welcome into Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. I'm Matt Peck, also host of Bulls Outsiders on NBC Sports Chicago, following all 82 Bulls games this season. You can follow me on Twitter at Bulls_Peck. You can follow my co-host Jordan Malley at Jordan C. Malley. And you can find us at Locked On Bulls. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/LockedOnShyBulls. Hit us up via email, LockedOnBulls@gmail.com. And of course, that text and voicemail line is always there for you, our fellow Bulls fans. 331-979-1369 is the number. Well, one day closer to All-Star festivities here in Chicago. We also got a pretty looming and dangerous forecast for All-Star weekend. Looks like Chicago might get dumped with several inches of snow in the next coming day or two. And that will be followed up with our first sub-zero temperatures of this current winter season. So I'm sure all NBA players inbound to Chicago, especially those from warm weather cities, are just even more thrilled to be on their way to the Windy City for All-Star weekend, as they are going to be trudging through snow and freezing their nuts off. So that'll be fun. But I mean, come on. Think back to 32 years ago, the last time All-Star weekend was here in Chicago, and we'll get to that more in a bit. It was also bitingly cold. There are some great stories, including some in Casey Johnson's current piece that's up on NBCSportsChicago.com about that incredible All-Star dunk contest in 88 between MJ and Dominique Wilkins, about the lack of room at the old Chicago Stadium and how some tents, media tents, had to be posted up outside of the stadium to accommodate all of the throngs of media, and that there were extensive measures taken to keep those tents warm, and even still, there were members of the media on typewriters wearing gloves because, hey, All-Star Weekend comes to Chicago. You gotta be prepared. So the Bulls have one more game on deck tonight. They're playing the Washington Wizards, and hopefully the Bulls can get into the All-Star break with a W, shorthanded as they are. This is one of the few teams that the Bulls managed to beat this season. So one more game, and then everybody gets a break, and then we get some fun All-Star activities in Chicago this weekend. A few things I wanted to touch on today. Casey Johnson's piece about the 88 dunk contest, as I just mentioned. There's also a very interesting column about Jimmy Butler, our old friend, by another one of our old friends, Nick Friedell, who used to be on the Bulls beat for many years. You actually have heard his voice on this very podcast, if you're a longtime listener, back from his days on the Bulls beat, now covering primarily the Golden State Warriors for ESPN, but just wrote a great column about Jimmy Butler, the Miami Heat, and how he has found his new home, and the ways in which the Jimmy Butler Bulls marriage fell apart a few years ago. And that set us on the course where we are now. So, obviously there's some hype around All-Star weekend. It's unfortunate that Zach LaVine is not participating in the dunk contest. I know a lot of Bulls fans were hoping that we might get him back in there after he was a back-to-back champion in 2015 and 2016 in his very young days in the NBA, especially after we heard that his rival Aaron Gordon had committed to the competition. But instead, we have Zach in the three-point contest, and hopefully we will get some exciting moments in both of those contests on All-Star Saturday night before the main event on Sunday. But this piece by Casey Johnson is incredible. If you haven't read it yet, I highly recommend that after you listen to this podcast, you go and do exactly that before you do anything else. It's a great oral history of the contest. There's also some on-camera interviews on the website as well from people who were there in the building, the old Chicago Stadium, February 6, 1988. People who were there photographing the event, David Falk, the former agent of not only Michael Jordan, but also his rival in that contest, Dominique Wilkins, and even current Chicago Bulls assistant coach, Karen Stack Umloff, who was at the time an assistant to Bulls GM Jerry Krause, who was there sitting courtside for this event, and also current NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, who was at the time just a law student at the University of Chicago, who bought himself a ticket to All-Star Saturday night to watch this historic event. It is an incredible storytelling work that's done here by Casey from all of these people, including not only Dominique himself, but another contestant and former dunk champion, Spud Webb, the undersized guy who was like Nate Robinson before Nate Robinson. I had a Spud Webb dunk contest poster on my wall growing up as a kid because I was so just enthralled by how somebody his size could be a dunk contest champion. Like the sheer physics of it didn't make sense to me. So you got Spud Webb in there. You have Jordan's old Bulls teammate, Charles Oakley. I mentioned Falk, MJ, and Dominique's old agent. Brian McIntyre, the retired NBA senior vice president of basketball communications. There are so many great accounts of this night and this particular event. Bill Smith, the longtime Bulls team photographer, who was the one who had the iconic photo that was captured of MJ from the sideline view. A lot of the photographers were on the baseline for this moment, this great moment in NBA history. But he talks in this oral history of Casey Johnson's that he, as the team photographer, was sort of given free rein wherever he wanted to go on and around the floor and around the court that night. And he decided that what he wanted was the sideline view so that you could see the scoreboard in the background. You could see as many, reactions from the crowd in the background from more of a landscaped shot. And it is the iconic shot that has MJ with, legs spread and flying behind him, palming the ball in his right hand, soaring through the air. And Casey Johnson was also on 670 The Score with Lawrence Holmes today talking about this piece and the fact that even when Casey Johnson was, just a lad in college in 1988, I believe he said he was a junior at Beloit at the time, watching this, and even in days and months and years after the fact, how often he would just stare at this picture that was, again, taken by Bulls team photographer Bill Smith, because it is an awe-inspiring photo, and it is one of the first things we associate with Be Like Mike, with his airness, with, that moment when that song, I Believe I Could Fly, starts playing towards the end of Space Jam, and MJ comes out from the alien spaceship. That whole idea of I Believe I Could Fly and Be Like Mike, yes, it's because of so many of the things he did in games. Some of the incredible, amazing, you have to see it to believe it, acrobatics that a young MJ put on in his early and prime years in the NBA in games. But even more so, this dunk. The dunk from the free throw line that happened at a time when, if you were lucky enough to be in the building that night, you witnessed history. And everyone in the stands is just waiting in anticipation. Adam Silver talks about the moments as MJ is walking all the way to the opposite end of the court and clearing photographers and cameras and legs of photographers out of his way to clear a path for this full court running start to a dunk from the free throw line. The anticipation in the building was electric. And it wasn't, you know, 15,000 people holding smartphones in front of their faces, watching this moment, capturing this moment on their phone so that they could, you know, put out on Twitter or Instagram the video of what they just saw two seconds later. This was at a time when people lived in the moment. And don't get me wrong, so much of what I love about being a sports fan and an NBA fan in particular, because I think NBA Twitter is the best Twitter. I think most NBA fans who are on Twitter would agree with that. It is a big part of being a fan now. And social media activity and engagement and interconnectivity among fans and athletes themselves is such a big part of sports fandom now. And it's an amazing thing. It's a wonderful gift the technology has given us. But God, what I wouldn't give to have been in that building, knowing and appreciating what I was watching, and to have that memory all these years later. In February of 1988, just so you have some perspective, I was not quite to my first birthday. I was born in March of 87. So I know the Jordan dunk contests well of 87 and 88. I know the stories behind the MJ-Dominique rivalry and the disputes and the differing opinions that existed with the judging of the scores of the dunks, and in particular Dominique getting shafted with a 45 on his two-handed full windmill dunk that he did from the baseline. That's one of the most thunderous, insane dunks the dunk contest has ever seen. And that, you know, Dominique in these interviews said, you know, when MJ was going to getting ready to do that free throw line dunk, and after getting the 45, he was like, the fix is in. Because MJ had the hometown crowd advantage. Everyone in that old Chicago stadium wanted to see MJ win that dunk contest, save for Dominique and maybe a few cheering for him. But it is such a big piece of the legend, the icon, the brand that is Air Jordan. The reason he is called Air Jordan is because of this dunk. And as I was just a kid figuring out how big of a deal the Bulls were and falling in love with Michael Jordan and the Bulls, anytime I could, I would watch that dunk contest. And, you know, YouTube clearly wasn't even around in my childhood. But anytime there was like a replay of the dunk contest on some channel, or anytime in current dunk contests, they would go back and show, you know, the iconic moments of dunk contests past. That dunk contest was everything. And it was between not just two guys who were really good dunkers, but two young stars on the rise, nearing, you know, the peak of their athletic prime, who, if Bulls and MJ and Dominique's Hawks would go on to have a pretty decent rivalry, among Eastern Conference contenders. Not quite to the length of the Bulls-Pistons rivalry, but it was pretty big. And MJ and Dominique were future Hall of Famers in the prime of their careers in the dunk contest. And I think that that's something that the dunk contest has lost over the years, is that the big names don't do it. You know, it's one of the biggest knocks people have on LeBron, that he never did the dunk contest. And for as good as the dunk contest was when Zach LaVine and Aaron Gordon really, you know, brought back some excitement to a contest that had been losing its luster, and no disrespect to Zach or Aaron Gordon, they're both quality basketball players, but they're not future Hall of Famers. They're not MJ and Neek. There are so many elements to what made that so special. And it's something that I wish I could have experienced. Probably like younger Bulls fans than me wish that they could have experienced any element of MJ's career in person, which I was lucky enough to do. The back half but not the front half. It's an amazing moment in NBA history. And again, Casey Johnson has done a phenomenal job with this telling. And there's more content too. Jason Goff did a podcast episode talking about it that you can catch on NBCSportsChicago.com as well. Check out the video with interviews of Dominique Wilkins and everybody else who was in and around the Chicago Stadium that night, including Bill Self, who took that iconic photo, which, you know, that iconic photo turned into a poster. It turned into a basketball card. I had that poster on my wall as a kid growing up, too, right next to the Spud Webb one. I have a basketball card of MJ doing that dunk. And it's, you know, I have a pretty big basketball card collection from my youth. Every chore that I ever did, every, you know, few bucks I got for taking out the trash or mowing the lawn for most of my childhood, all of those dollars went to the local basketball card store. Batter Up Baseball Cards in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. I don't even think it's there anymore. But who knows how long I'll hold on to my basketball card collection. If I end up, you know, getting married and having kids someday, I'm sure that I would love nothing more than to pass on that element of my fandom as a Bulls fan to my kids. But I don't know if I can give them that one. I might just keep that one for myself. The MJ 88 dunk contest card. I have a lot of sports memorabilia. That one's special. If you've been a listener of this podcast, I'm sure you've heard all the great advertisers working with the Locked On Network to reach sports fans. But you may not know that Locked On Bulls is a great way for your local business to reach passionate Bulls fans just like you. Unlike any other podcast, Locked On gives your local company the unique ability to reach local podcast listeners. Not just any podcast listeners, a Locked On podcast listener. If your company wants to connect with Bulls fans and a predominantly male audience that is well-educated with disposable income, then let's put your company right here on this Locked On podcast. Local fans love to support local businesses. Text the word advertising to 33777 or visit lockedonpodcast.com/advertising and let us know who you are. We'll get our team to help your team achieve Locked On advertising success. Once again, text the word advertising to 33777 or visit lockedonpodcasts.com/advertising. We look forward to hearing from you. Now then, next thing on the agenda is this column about Jimmy Butler and his new home with the Heat by our old friend Nick Friedel. Really good read. Highly recommend that you read this after you read Casey Johnson's oral history of the 88 dunk contest. A lot of great content out there as we get closer to All-Star weekend here in Chicago. And it brings up a very reactionary topic among the Bulls fan base right now, because it seems like the Jimmy Butler trade and the start of this rebuild is a lifetime ago, because time drags on when you're miserable. Certainly seems to. And there's no denying that the first nearly three seasons of this rebuild after trading away Jimmy Butler, an all-NBA caliber talent, has not gone the way we wanted it to. We knew that at least year one would be bad, and the Bulls kind of screwed themselves by failing to tank properly. You know, thank goodness that 7-game winning streak netted him a first-round pick to send away Nico Mirotic so that we could get Chandler Hutchison on board for the rebuild. Yes, there is a significant layer of sarcasm with that comment, but year two, I still thought was going to be a tough year. I didn't know it was going to be as bad as it was. The team was hit by some injuries to key players. Yep. Made a big move. Sent away the Jabari Parker, Bobby Portis pairing for Otto after the Jabari experiment was an unmitigated disaster, and the Bulls knew that they couldn't come to terms with Bobby based on what he wanted financially nearing the end of his rookie deal. And year three is even worse than year two. Maybe the Bulls are on pace to win a few more games than they did last year, which again resulted in another disappointing result of the draft lottery. But where we are now, nearing the All-Star break, 16 games under 500, despite having played arguably the much easier part of our schedule. And we do have some winnable matchups here coming out of the All-Star break to finish the month of February. But then March and April happen. And March and April is the reason that I'm telling any Bulls fan out there still clinging to hope about a potential, you know, Bulls 8 seed playoff berth. You're missing for the forest for the trees, people. Ain't no way that's happening, and you shouldn't want that to happen. The Bulls squeaking in as an 8 seed that's 15 or maybe 12 games under 500, all it does is placate people who love to be placated. Jerry can have some home playoff games as the Bulls get bounced in the first round. Maybe the changes we all want to happen that we are hearing might actually finally happen don't happen. If that small sliver of positivity is shown and they can say, hey, look, we made the playoffs. No. Big picture, people. Big picture. So for all those reasons, this piece by Nick Friedell about Jimmy and how happy he is in Miami and how well the Miami Heat are doing with Jimmy leading the charge, I think has struck a chord with a lot of Bulls fans because of where we are now. Because, you know, I tweeted this earlier today when I was quote tweeting the link to this article by Nick. I'm not going to pretend that I have been firmly entrenched in one camp or the other since the day Jimmy was traded to say from day one, this was a good idea or this was a bad idea. I had certainly, at least for the most part, voiced my understanding of why they did it. And even as recently as, you know, this past, not this season, but last season, and Lauri Markkanen's rookie season, when we saw these signs of positivity from Lowry and Zach LaVine specifically, and even knowing that the Bulls, you know, a little less than a year ago had given up on Chris Dunn and were ready to trade him, even if Zach and Lowry were as good, on their way to being as good as they looked like they could be, that, coupled with the financial commitment to Jimmy, was enough for me to feel good about saying, all right, well, you know, you could say the Bulls won that trade, but the whole which team won the trade thing, whatever. I feel like it's a weird term to say this team won the trade, this team lost the trade. I think right now, the Bulls and the Timberwolves both lost the trade, and the person who won that trade was Jimmy Butler, who is now happy after a few different stops in Miami. But at least I could understand why the Bulls did it. Because, look, Jimmy was an amazing talent. He went from being the 15th guy at the end of Tibbs' bench playing behind Luol Deng, who was a 44 minutes a night player, to being the best player on the team. The player that the Bulls said, all right, this is our guy now. We're going to move on from Derek and Joakim. We're going to trade Derek. We're going to let Joakim walk in free agency. This is Jimmy's team now. And how quickly they backpedaled on that decision. And there are a lot of factors there, but they backpedaled. And a huge mistake in this path, in my opinion, was the three alphas year. Because if you really want to commit to building around Jimmy, why in God's name, after Gar Foreman says, we're going to get younger, we're going to get more athletic, the Bulls 180, because the unicorn, the white whale, the guy that the Bulls had wanted since he came into the league in 2003 when John Paxson was just taken over as the VP of this, or the general manager of this team, Dwayne Wade, in the twilight of his career, has some silly little spat with Pat Riley about getting what he's owed and wants to stick it to Riley and Heat owner Mickey Arison to say, well, You know who wants me? You know who has always wanted me? You know, that team that's always had a crush on me, and I've always kind of strung them along. My hometown team, you know, my backup, in case I don't get to, you know, fall in love with and marry the person that I've always been lusting after, but there's this backup who I'm keeping on the hook over here. That's what the Bulls were to Dwayne Wade. And he used them because they were stupid enough to let him. And y'all know that's part of why I have this horrible vendetta against Dwayne Wade. And yes, I know that it's more so the Bulls front office's fault for falling for that stupid idea of signing Wade than it is Dwayne's fault. But even still, that's where that comes from. So you sign Dwayne Wade and you sign Rajon Rondo and you get the three alphas here. Who could have guessed that that would have gone horribly, horribly wrong? And there are some who say, well, you know, they got through some tough times and, you know, they snuck into that eighth seed with, you know, based on a tiebreaker between eighth and ninth seed, like a barely 500 team. And they took those two first games from Boston. They would have won that series if Rondo didn't get hurt. Y'all know I think that's a bunch of bullshit. I don't think the Bulls were winning that series even if Rondo stays healthy. And they certainly weren't winning anything after that. But it was such a foolish decision for the Bulls because you take a player like Jimmy, who turned himself into a very high caliber offensive player and thus a great two-way player, a top, arguably top 15 two-way player in the NBA. And you his one weakness, you're not a great shooter. So what do? As his two running mates, you sign guys who are aging and also can't shoot. In the quickly transforming NBA, remember, this three alphas year of 16-17, the league's starting to take up on this trend of, oh, look what the Warriors are doing. Oh, look what the Rockets are doing. Maybe we should make three-point shooting an emphasis. And instead of putting some shooters around Jimmy and building a team and spending money wisely to build around Jimmy a team that could be complementary to Jimmy's skills, for the sake of not being able to say no to that person they've always lusted after, for not being able to say no to the dollar signs that they saw with Dwayne Wade jerseys and bodies through turnstiles at the United Center. Chicago native, Dwayne Wade, finally a Bull. You fucking idiots. You fell for it. You duped yourselves. And you built a crummy basketball team. That's when the Jimmy Butler being the Bulls' leader, leading a team that was actually going to contend for championships, fell apart. The day they signed Dwayne Wade. And of course, the other element of that was that I think Dwayne Wade's presence only pushed forward this Jimmy's a diva now problem as he became a well-paid player, you know, bet on himself after turning down the Bulls, you know, modest extension from his rookie deal and then becomes a first-time All-Star with the huge jump in his scoring and his numbers across the board and then nets himself that $90 million deal. And with that, Jimmy became no longer just a kid from Tomball. Jimmy became Jimmy Buckets, BFFs with, you know, NFL star Demaryius Thomas and Hollywood, you know, celeb Mark Wahlberg and all that other Jimmy stuff. And was some of that overblown? Yes. Is Jimmy's ego and diva problem, was it painted to be a bigger problem than it was by the Bulls and some in the Bulls media who wanted that picture to be painted to justify not ultimately giving Jimmy that Supermax extension and committing to building around him? Yes. And in Jimmy's defense, a lot of the stuff that made him, you know, a locker room problem, a cancer, a diva, all that stuff, at the base of it, it was mostly about Jimmy just wanting to win. And I mean, again, preface this by saying it's not a direct comparison, but it's a correlation. Jimmy demands from his teammates that they work as hard as he does, that they care as much as he does. And there's some great testimonial in this Nick Friedell piece from some of Jimmy's young teammates now on the Heat, like Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson and others, saying, holy crap, this guy works hard. I thought I worked hard, and I thought I was working hard enough, and then I became teammates with Jimmy Butler. And it makes perfect sense when you think about the episodes that happened in Minnesota, where, you know, he thought Wiggins and Towns and those kids were soft, didn't work hard enough, didn't care enough about winning. You know, the legendary practice where he's saying, you know, you fucking need me. Forces his way out of there, goes to Philly, sees that there's some dysfunction in Philly, thinks Simmons and Embiid are soft, that there are fractures there. It's not about winning. It's about individual egos. And he finally found himself this home Miami where it's about winning. Heat culture. As much as Bulls fans hate it, we got the better of that rivalry in the 90s. Alonzo Mourning and those guys, they didn't win shit when MJ was running things. Early 2000s, Bulls got the short end of that stick while Wade and LeBron and Bosh were kicking us out of the playoffs. But it's always been Pat Riley's show. He's always been one of the most respected executives in the league after he left coaching to be an executive. And Eric Spoelstra is a hell of a coach. And when they were teammates in Chicago and then they weren't, Wade came back to Spo and Riley and said, Jimmy is a Heat guy. And yeah, the Heat are gambling a little bit on putting Jimmy at the front of their franchise. Right now, so far, it looks like that gamble is paying off a bit, because the Heat are unexpectedly not only a playoff-bound team in the East, but a much higher seed than many anticipated. And a lot of that is Jimmy, who, as you know, an all-star once again this season, averaging 26-6. And a lot of that is also the high caliber of play of some of these younger pieces, that credit to the Heat organization for finding talent in unlikely places. And we'll see how far they go in the playoffs this year, and we'll see what this Heat team with Jimmy at the forefront does. I still don't think it's championship caliber roster, but you know that Riley will never quit trying to make it that. And, you know, latest example, not only getting Jimmy, but prying Andre Iguodala. Another quality veteran piece. Championship experience. Heat culture, hell of a lot better than Bulls culture right now. And that's the gamble the Bulls didn't want to make. That's the reason the Bulls painted this picture of Jimmy as he's not the humble kid from Tomball, Texas anymore. He's Diva Jimmy Buckets. And again, some of that was true. Like, towards the tail end of the Jimmy Bulls years, where he was not dressing with the team in the locker room, but dressing off somewhere else by himself. And the whole episode after they coughed up that, you know, big lead to the Atlanta Hawks, you know, in, I want to say, like, mid-November of that 3-Alpha season. And then that was the post-game locker room where Dwayne Wade went off on the young guys, and then Jimmy Butler followed suit saying, you know, these motherfuckers, they don't want to win enough and this and that. And then Rondo clapped back defending the young players, saying that Jimmy and Wade were bad leaders. And, like, all of that was bad, ugly stuff. And that was the Bulls airing dirty laundry to the entire NBA. Media, fans, everybody heard that story. And it was ugly. And it was part of what gave Jimmy that label. And I understand to some extent that the Bulls didn't want to deal with that. That they saw Jimmy's ever-growing ego as a problem. if they, coupled with that concern about a growing ego, truly believed that they could not build a championship team with Jimmy as its core piece. But if you're going to make the, if you're not going to make the risk of committing to that player long term to be the central character, core piece of a team that can really, honest to God, contend for a championship, you got to have a lot of faith that you have the right people in your building to build the right pieces and acquire the right pieces when you get rid of that guy and start over. And I think that's why right now Bulls fans are so frustrated and second-guessing this Jimmy Butler trade, because right now, as much as we have appreciation for what Zach LaVine is doing, and as much as some of us, myself included, still don't want to give up on Lauri Markkanen as a high-ceiling potential player in this league who's still very young, none of the pieces the Bulls have right now are anywhere close to Jimmy Butler. Not even close. The contract was big, though. And I think that is still something that is making me cling on to the hope that maybe the Jimmy trade will work out for the best. I find it harder and harder to believe. But you think about the contract that he signed, his sign-and-trade to bring him from Philly to Miami. 4 years, $140 million and change. That is almost $100 million less than the Supermax designated player exception contract that Jimmy was on his way to getting if the Bulls decided to keep him. The five-year deal that could only be given to the team that drafted him, and the DPE-level contract that could pay Jimmy or any other such qualifying player the, whatever it was, like 35% of the team's entire salary cap, that is the deal that was on the table for Jimmy if the Bulls wanted to keep him. You're talking about paying that guy over a five-year contract $225 million. And those numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger as Jimmy got older and older and older. The figures he's making with the Heat now, 32 this year, 34 next year, 36 and 21, 22 in 22, 23, 37.6, big numbers. Those numbers even bigger if the Bulls kept him. And if the Bulls couldn't build around Jimmy when he was on a max contract that was only $90 million over the course of the seasons that the contract was for, and was not that huge of a percentage of the entire team's salary cap, how could they have done it when they were giving an aging Jimmy Butler a third of their team's total salary cap? And again, that's not only to say I understand why they didn't. It's also an indictment on their inability to build a roster around him. I still hold firm in my belief that Jimmy Butler is not a good enough star to be the number one piece on a championship-winning team. And if you're not winning championships, if you're not working towards winning a championship, if you're not building towards winning a championship, then what are you doing? And that was the mired in mediocrity shit that the Bulls didn't want to be, or at least that's what they told us they didn't want to be. Even though, you know, we've always heard the stuff about Jerry Reinsdorf, I perpetually want my team to finish in second place. You can keep the fan base wanting more, and how sinister is that? But they said, we're trading Jimmy and starting over because we don't see him as the right guy to build a championship team around. So we're going to start over. Okay, you started over. We're almost 3 years into you starting over, and the Bulls are about as far away from winning a championship as the organization has ever fucking been. That's why it's really hard to see Jimmy leading a Miami Heat team that is surprisingly good right now. That's why it gets harder and harder for those of us who wanted to believe that the Bulls maybe didn't quote-unquote win the Butler trade, but at least did an okay thing, made a smart move, looked for the future of actually trying to build something that could contend instead of staying stuck in mediocrity. Because as Jimmy is your best player, You're an 8 seed. That's what the Bulls built. The Bulls built a team around Jimmy Butler that was an 8 seed. So what's so great about that? You want to pay a guy a third of your entire team's salary cap in the back end of his prime with a lot of miles on those legs, thanks to one Tom Thibodeau? You want to pay him all that money to be a recurring 6th or 7th or 8th seed? I mean, Bulls fans everywhere might be saying right now, well, hell, I'd take that over what we're watching right now. And I certainly get that. I certainly get that notion. But it's complicated. As a kid of the 90s, I want championships. I want more. I'm a Chicago sports fan across the board, but by and large, diehard, diehardiest, pumps through my blood the mostiest, I am a Bulls fan and always will be. I want more rings. I want more banners. I want more of those memories because the ones from my childhood are fleeting, and it kills me that they're fleeting. Jimmy is the best player. Didn't really get him all that close. Jimmy and a kind of healthy Derrick Rose got them back to, what, the conference semis? Some of you might be out there crying, oh, David Blatt tried to call a timeout he didn't have. The Bulls got robbed in that series. Whatever. As close as they got. I understand why they decided to tear it down and start over. But right now, because of their own incompetence to build a roster, put the right people in positions of power, hire the right coaches, employ the proper medical staff to keep their team healthy. The rebuild has gone nowhere. Nowhere. And right now, the only winner of the Jimmy Butler trade that sent him away to Minnesota almost 3 years ago is Jimmy Butler. That's it for today. Enjoy the Bulls' last game before the All-Star break tonight. We'll see if we can get a little Zach LaVine-Bradley Beal showdown part two between two of the snubbed guards among East All-Star votes. And we will be back tomorrow with a fresh episode. Take some mailbag content. Hit us up on that text and voicemail line, 331-979-1369. Hit us up on Twitter, LockedOnBulls, Bulls_Peck, and Jordan C. Malley. Shoot us an email, LockedOnBulls@gmail.com. For my partner, Jordan Malley, Matt Peck, saying thanks for listening, Bulls Nation. Have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow. Peace out.
Locked On Bulls, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA. For more content and to stay up to date, head over to LockedOnBulls.com